This is the Western Obsessions TV podcast, where hunting's not a hobby, it's an obsession.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Western Obsessions TV podcast. I'm your host, Kurt Belding. My guest today is Lee Hawk with Tooth of the Arrow Broadheads. I got joined up with Tooth of the Arrow Broadheads just a little over a year ago. And really enjoy their product, guys. And I got Lee on here. Lee's kind of the expert, the guy, kind of the guy that does most of the stuff with Tooth of the Arrow Broadheads. So if you see him here, him on the YouTube channel, I got him today on the podcast. Lee, how's it going, man?
I'm great, man. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, man. I appreciate being on. For sure, in this podcast, we're going to dig into your carbon steel broadheads, what makes those different, and get into some stuff that you're doing, kind of your background and maybe some future stuff. So stick around on this podcast. We're going to get into some fun, interesting things. But Lee, let's start off kind of like, let's get to know you a little bit. Tell me about where you grew up and kind of what you've done up to this point.
Right on, man. Well, first of all, I'm a Canadian, which throws a lot of people off because, you know, Tooth of the Arrow, all American. So everything's American about the company except for me. I am born and raised in Calgary. The hunting is too good here to ever leave. But, you know, I grew up in a hunting family and picked up a bow when I was just a kid and started bow hunting as soon as it was legal here. And, you know, I went to school for finance and just I got my degree and whatever, blah, blah, blah. But I wanted to hunt and I wanted to do archery, and it's blown up, and that's my career now. Is, you know, I run the YouTube channel, I do most things at Tooth of the Arrow between me and Luke, the owner. I have a full service archery shop, I'm a string builder, you know, there's hunting is my life. That's all it is for me.
Yeah, and I know you live in Calgary right now, and honestly I'm a little bit jealous. I mean, right now I live in Colorado, but I grew up in the Midwest of the United States in Nebraska, and whitetail was amazing. I was obviously amazing whitetail hunting. Pheasant, turkey was cool, but I did not get to do like the bigger game, elk and moose and mountain, all the cool stuff, man. I did not grow up doing that. So my learning curve to go elk hunting when I moved to Colorado, it was about 15-20 years ago, was pretty substantial. If I would have grown up out here, I feel like I would have like maybe learned a little bit faster. How was it growing up in like that hunting area?
Well, I mean, elk, I know that's what you do primarily. I believe it. Elk is a steep learning curve, whether you grow up with it or not. But certainly living in Alberta, it's pretty cool because you're, you know, one weekend you're hunting elk, the next you're on a moose hunt, the next you're on a mule deer hunt, the next you're on a whitetail hunt. And so you learn just through exposure for sure. But elk hunting, it's still, I think, the hardest thing to do in Alberta, maybe, I guess, exclusive of the sheep. The sheep is a totally different beast. But I mean, growing up with it, it certainly gives you an upper hand, I think, just in that your lifestyle revolves around it from a young age. And like I say, the hunting is too good here to leave. There's just so many species and our seasons are super well regulated, in my opinion. I mean, we got 2 full months of archery before the rifle guys show up. So Alberta is amazing. You should definitely come hunt Alberta if you ever have a chance.
Absolutely. You guys definitely got to go do that. I've hunted Alberta, was it 2 years ago, I think, for moose. And that was a fun, interesting, it was bow hunting moose. That was an interesting experience, man. Like learning and listening to the calls. And obviously I had no clue what I was doing. So I had an outfitter that I was hunting with, but as interesting hunting the cuts, you know, cause it's like super dense forest. So you're hunting like the timber cuts and stuff like that, man. It was a lot of fun. Go ahead.
What parts of Alberta were you in for moose?
Man, it was right out of, now you got me on the spot and I don't remember.
Our 2 big cities are Calgary, where I am, and then Edmonton is in the north.
I think it was in the north. So it must've been maybe like 2 to 3 hours away from that, from Eddington.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time in that area, man. It is thick brush up there. Like a few years ago, I was hunting in, you know, once you kind of get north of the wall, we say in Edmonton, that's the wall in Alberta, because that's where our population it's just drops. It is some of the thickest bush, as you saw. Like I remember I did a 6-day elk hunt up there, and we had a bull in at least one bull within 25 every day, but I didn't kill him because the timber was so thick I couldn't get a shot off.
Oh my God. Yeah, you probably didn't even see him barely within 25, huh?
No, you don't see him until you're practically on top of them, and that sure gets your heart racing.
Yeah, I'm sure. So what's your favorite species to hunt there in Canada?
Bow hunting, I love hunting. Well, you know, my answer changes depending on what I'm hunting, but in the off season, I always say whitetail. There's something about sitting in a stand in that frigid cold hunting whitetail that just gets me going, man. I love it. Kind of the intimate relationship you can build with a buck over the summer and even over years watching a certain deer, if you have the right setup, it's an incredible thing. But I mean, I absolutely love mule deer hunting too. I love the physical aspect of it and how involved you are. But you know, this surprises people. I always say, if I could only hunt one animal for the rest of my life, I would hunt coyotes, because I am obsessed with coyotes. I think it's the biggest thrill of hunting, period, is having two or three dogs running into you. It's insane.
So do you call coyotes?
Yeah, I call them. I've sat over bait a few times, but calling them is just so fun. I mean, you wait for the coldest stretches you can, which this weekend's going to be good. It's getting down into the minus 30s here. So I'm going to be out calling, and it's just a rush. My goal this year, though, is to kill them with my bow, which is super hard to do when you're calling.
Yeah. Yeah, because and I've called a little bit growing up in Nebraska. We did a little bit of calling, and they're a smart animal, man. Like, they'll come in, but they get a little leery when they're not seeing that sound that they're hearing.
Yeah, everything out there is after the coyote. Everything hates the coyote. So I have a huge amount of respect. You know, there's that old Ian Tyson song, The Coyote and the Cowboy. If you haven't heard that one, look it up. It's just a great song about the respect we should have for the coyote. The tricky thing is I love mouth calling, like hand calling them, because it's, you know, it's kind of akin to tying your own flies as a fly fisherman, right? Versus e-calls. But then they're pinpointing where you are and where that sound comes from. So it adds another element to it.
Yeah. So do you like just brush in to on the ground when you do that?
It depends. Like when I'm doing it with my bow, I'm going to be doing it from my tree stand. But generally I like to sit. I have a long bipod with my rifle, and I just like to sit, try to get in some brush, and I wear a really white camo. But I mean, if you're out in the open, they'll see you. And the biggest thing is if you move, like even your barrel moving a couple inches when they're looking at you, they're gone. They're incredibly wary animals.
Yeah, completely gone. So when you're gonna try that, you're gonna try that this year with the bow?
Yeah, that's my big goal. I've never done it. I've shot a coyote with my bow, but like out of a blind in Mexico while I was waiting for coos deer. So I want to call one in the frigid cold.
That would be super fun, man. And you're gonna go up in a tree to do it and see if you can get them to come within. What's your range there with a coyote?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they're going to jump a string or not. I don't even know if I'll be able to draw my bow if that movement is, if they see that out of the corner, they're gone. So I'm going to put, if you haven't seen them before, it looks almost like a kid's toy. It's like a little base with a post and a spinner on it that looks kind of like, you know, one of those dog toys that doesn't have any stuffing in it. It looks just like that. It spins around. So the coyote will see that and think it's the dying rabbit or whatever, and they'll tackle those things. So I'm going to put that right at 25 and we'll see what happens. I think my odds of missing are significantly higher than hitting, but you got to try.
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you're talking about. It's like a little tail that kind of spins around and it looks like the dying rabbit. Yeah. I was hunting in Mexico. I was hunting mule deer. And I killed the first day, and that ranch I was hunting on had a really bad coyote problem. So I was like, they had a call, a nice electrical call, was a mouth call. So I went out for half a day and killed four coyotes in like,
wow,
2 hours with that call. And one of them like tackled the call, like went right up to it, like almost bit it. But man, it was a blast. I forgot how much fun that was, you know?
Oh, it's a thrill. And I mean, hunting Mexico, I've hunted mule deer and coos deer down there a couple times too. That's a great hunt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you get a good mule deer when you were down there?
Yeah, it was a good deer. They have a couple different little species down there. So it was a Kruki mule deer. They don't get as big as the Sonoran mule deer. An old buck, man, super old, just like still healthy, but like his coat was like super kind of grayish white, and his horns were in decline. So I was real happy with that kill in Mexico.
That's what you want, man. There's never shame in taking a, you know, I killed a whitetail buck a few years ago that was definitely on the decline. So not a massive buck, but you can see it in their neck and they're just slow and they're cocky. And that's a trophy, man. Age matters.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you. I enjoy that. But at the same time, man, I'm not too good to say I'll shoot a 2-year-old deer too, you know, like especially hunting with my daughter, you know what I mean? Like if she wants to shoot something, shoot it. I don't care. You know, it's the experience. For me, it's the experience more than the trophy of like what you're doing, where you're doing it at, and how much fun you're having, you know? So.
Oh, totally. It's bow hunting is so hard. Hunting period is so hard these days. And, you know, there's more and more hunters out there. It's a tricky balancing act between, you know, the conservation aspect and trophy hunting, but also just letting people have fun. You know, bow hunting is tough, and I commend anybody who's just getting into bow hunting.
Yeah, it's definitely a learning curve, and it's very popular right now. It seems like bow hunting is the most popular, and bow hunting elk, right? And I think a lot of that comes from some of our bigger name guys that have a good reach, like Cam Haines and Joe Rogan. They talk a lot and they bow hunt, and a lot of people follow them. And what I feel bad about is people have an expectation when they start bow hunting, like, oh, I'm just gonna go shoot a bow and it's gonna be so much fun, and I'm gonna go out and kill my first elk or first animal. And that's the expectation, where like me and you know that we've been bow hunting since we've been little kids, that's rarely the case, you know? So yeah, I kind of feel bad about it. What's your thoughts?
It's something that I don't think new bow hunters can realize until they put in the effort. And I think it, you know, one season is enough to scare most new archers and bow hunters away. But I mean, you hear it all the time. It's like, I'm going to get into hunting and I'm going to get a bow this summer and I'm going to go bow hunting this fall. It's, man, get a bow this spring and shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot. But start out rifle hunting. First of all, learn what it feels to kill an animal. Mm-hmm. Learn what it feels like, because it's not a fun thing and it's very emotional. And to do it with a bow just brings out so much more. It's so much more difficult and personal. It's, yeah, I mean, bow hunting, you can't just grab a bow and go hunting. It's not that easy. But, you know, the TV shows make it seem like that. And, you know, I try to tell a lot of stories on my YouTube and write blogs about my failures as a bow hunter, because there isn't much that is talked about in terms of your failures. If you're just getting into it and you're on YouTube and listening to podcasts and whatever, it just sounds like if you're not out there seeing animals and killing stuff, you suck. And that's not the reality of it. It's hard.
Yeah, it's a really good point, man. I made a couple of good, really good points of start out rifle hunting. Give yourself a little more higher percent chance to actually harvest an animal and see what that feels like. You may not like it. You know, that first, and I've taken my sister hunting and she harvested her first animal, killed an animal, and like did not enjoy it at all. And she will not do it again. Right. So that might be the case. And then, yeah, the perception of social media and some shows you may be watching is like, it looks like every time someone goes out, they're killing an animal and everyone's killing these big mature animals. And that is not the case. That's like 10% of the people that hunt are actually even harvesting anything, you know, so.
100%, man. And you know, like you say, people go out and shoot an animal with a rifle and they realize they don't like it. I've got that same story. My aunt did the exact same thing. She started crying and she hated it. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, I know you do a lot of education for new hunters. So hopefully there's a bunch of new hunters listening to this. My one piece of advice would just be do everything you can to make sure that you don't wound that animal. Start with a rifle. Get close, pass on a shot you're not 100% certain you're going to make. Because, I mean, I've been bow hunting half my life. You've been bow hunting probably double the time I have or more. And every wound, and I've wounded animals, we all have, it's every single one is in my head. They keep me awake. it sucks, and you do not want your first experience to be like that.
Absolutely, man. That is the absolute worst thing in hunting, is when you shoot and wound an animal. And it's easy to do when you're bow hunting. You're 100%. And that's probably the fastest way to end someone starting to hunt, is them to wound an animal. Even me, like you said, I shot my first deer at 8 years old, and now I'll be 43 with a bow, and I'll be 44. God, you get so old, man. You start forgetting how old you are. I'll be 44 this year. And last year I wounded an elk, did not retrieve it with a bow. And I almost quit bow hunting because of it. Like it shook me so bad that, and I've been doing it for, 30 plus years, and it still shakes me real bad. So, yeah, I agree with you 100%. Because shoot your bow, and shooting your bow is a lot of fun. I have a blast shooting my bow. I don't have to hunt anything. I can go out and just shoot my bow for hours, and it's so much fun, man.
Totally. And when you start shooting your bow, just go shoot small game, find a field with a bunch of gophers, or, find rabbits or squirrels or whatever. Just start getting used to shooting at something that's not a pink dot on a target, something that's moving. And that's a great kind of slow introduction into what bow hunting is and what it feels like. Cause I mean, like you say, I have wounded a few animals, and the one that really sticks out to me is the whole hunt is on YouTube. A mountain goat hunt I did a couple of years ago in BC, and I took a just about felt like straight downhill shot. It's all on video, which, I ended up hitting this goat in the ass, and it ran off, and we watched it still standing as the sun went down, but we knew it was bleeding. And I mean, you don't sleep in your tent that night at all. And it took a day or two, and we did track it down, and I shot it with a rifle, but there was no other option. But at that point, you just gotta do your duty as a hunter and finish the job. But when that happened, I started crying, and it's all on video. I just started pouring tears, and I'm not ashamed of that. It's emotional. It's a big deal. It's an animal's life, and it sticks with you, man.
It does, man. I'll have to watch that. Is that on Tooth of the Arrow or like your own?
It's on Dustin Rowe's channel. Backcountry BC and Beyond. It was really well done. It was one of the Sitka photographers came along and filmed the whole thing. It was really well done production.
Really cool, man. I have to watch that. But yeah, you're right. Like, even a veteran hunter makes mistakes, and it's a very emotional thing. It's a very emotional thing just to kill an animal and have it die quickly. That's still a very emotional. Yeah. Cool, man. Hey, absolutely, man. Here's a little bit here. Let's talk about Tooth of the Arrow broadheads and how you came along with those guys, and we'll kind of get into some nitty gritty of the broadheads themselves. I got introduced to you guys, like I said, a little over a year ago, and I enjoy the broadheads a lot, man. I like them. They fly well. They're tough. What I probably like about them the most is, like, I love the four blade just square. Like, it just punches a square right through the animal, and it's deadly, man. So give me some background. How'd you get started with Tooth of the Arrow?
Well, when I was in high school and in university bow hunting, I was on a lot of pro staffs because I don't have very much money as a student, and you want to hunt a lot. So I was taking a ton of pictures and filming and stuff for a lot of companies. And Tooth of the Arrow was a company that I ended up being on just their pro staff. Ended up loving the broadheads. I've never had a bad experience with them. And I shot them for 2 or 3 years before Luke, the owner, he was running the entire show for years completely alone. Him and his dad started it, but Luke was running it. And he reached out to Pro Staff page asking for someone who would do just part-time, basically sales, trying to get the broadheads into more archery shops in the States. And I thought, perfect, I'm in university. I can, a few hours a day here and there. So I did that, and one thing led to another, finished school and started Tooth of the Arrow full-time. I didn't design the broadhead. I just love it, and I truly believe in it.
Yeah. So if your opinion, and you've shot a lot, obviously you've archery hunted a lot. You've shot a lot of broadheads. This is not a sales pitch. I'm not asking. I'm asking, what do you think's the difference, man? Like, what made you fall in love with Tooth of the Arrow and enjoy that broadhead?
Well, I love a four blade because, four blade versus a three blade, you get one more slice, right? It's and if you see a picture, like you said, of the what these look like when you shoot them through, you know, sheet of steel or something, you can see they make a square hole, and it's not like they're cutting, it's like they're goring a gaping wound through the animal. So I really believe in that four blade design. There's a lot of four blade broadheads out there. The first animal I ever shot when I was like 12 was a cougar with some other four blade. I still have it, and I have it because it's totally bent over after one shot out of like a 40 pound bow. And so back to why I love Tooth of the Arrow. Long before I worked for them, one piece, the whole thing is steel. There's no aluminum. There's no moving parts. There's no room for failure. And that's a big thing for me, is I can't stand aluminum when it comes to archery components, whether it's your insert, or I don't even like aluminum arrows because they bend over time. And aluminum ferrules is just a deadly thing on a broadhead, and not in a good way.
Right. No, 100%. I'm with you. And I'm old enough to, like, you know, my first bow, our first couple of years of shooting a bow, it was a compound bow, but no sights, and it was all aluminum arrows. And, you know, you would be really, if you had one arrow that was straight, that means you weren't shooting that arrow ever, you know, so yeah. You had to like re-bend the arrow back out. And the broadheads were just razor blades that either were held in there with a rubber band or somehow screwed in there, but they were all aluminum. The blades would fall out all the time, super dangerous. I mean, obviously advancements, technologies from then to now are great. But what I really liked about the Tooth Arrow broadheads, I think you guys have sent me a pack and I wanted to try out, or I can't remember exactly what it was, but I like it's all one piece. There is no moving parts, that it's cut from one piece of steel, so you don't have to worry about a blade falling out. You know, I like the carbon steel thing. I shot Montex for a long time, and I'd never had a very good experience with expandable blades. It sounds weird because they're supposed to fly just like a field tip, but that was just never my experience. It just never flew well for me, expandable blades. I don't know why, just my experience. So I always lean towards a fixed blade and not a mechanical. What's your thoughts from fixed to mechanical?
Well, you know, you bring up a few interesting points. The one thing I see come up all the time, anytime I post something, particularly on Facebook, the haters come out and they always say, it's all about shot placement. It's all about shot placement. Yeah, 100%. No one's arguing that. You can shoot a field point at an animal, hit them in both lungs, they're going to die extremely quickly. But you need a broadhead that will hold up and do its job when your shot placement isn't perfect. Because to think that we are always going to make a perfect shot is extremely arrogant, and that's not going to happen. Or even if you do make it perfect shot, string jumping happens. Animal takes a step, you know, you hit a blade of grass can deflect an arrow. You know, there's just so much that can happen. So it's all about that plan B. And between fixed blades and mechanicals, there's a few reasons I really prefer a fixed blade. The first being that plan B shot, just like we talked about. You know, a mechanical broadhead doesn't hold up the bone the way a fixed blade will. It's as simple as that. And the second really big point will be that I believe mechanicals, generally they do fly better than fixed blades, but that is because of people's setups. And if you're someone who's out there saying mechanicals shoot great out of my bow, but I can't get fixed blades to fly, there's an issue with your bow. It's as simple as that. So shooting a fixed blade forces you to actually work on your equipment and actually make sure your setup is perfect, as it should be, because this is animals' lives we're dealing with, and there's no reason to just take the easy route.
Right. No, good point. Which brings me to something I need to get better at, is understanding my bow better. Like, I just started kind of building my own arrows over the last couple of years. And for the longest time, I'm like, man, I just don't want to spend the time and energy to do it, and I don't want to figure out the best ways to do it, so I'll have someone else do it. And that was the same thing with my bow. Is like, oh, I'll just take it to the bow shop that I feel comfortable with and let these guys, they're the experts, so let these guys do it. What I really found was, like, it's just fun, man. It's, I don't care if I even, like, I can fuck up arrows all the time, but it's just fun. I'll shoot a fucked up arrow, like, you know what yeah. I mean? Yeah, in practice or whatever, I'll take the best ones in the field, but it's just fun, man, to like build your own weapons that way. And I need to get better at tuning my bow and figuring out my own bow myself, just spending that time to do it. But you're right. Like, you know, if they're not flying correctly, 9 times out of 10, your bow, something needs to happen with your bow.
Yeah. There's so much equipment blaming. And sometimes it is equipment. Sometimes there is, you know, your arrow is poorly built and it's not square. You're not going to get anything to fly. Your components are poorly built, or, you know, the dude who set up your bow did a bad job. And a lot of the time it's you, you know, like hand position is so underrated. When you get shooting fixed blade broadheads at, you know, 80, 100 yards, if your hand position, and I'm talking your bow hand, is not perfectly consistent and torque free every shot, they're not going to shoot well. So I think there's too much equipment blaming out there for sure. But no, it's important for everyone to know about their gear. I mean, think about guys who do like insane off-roading with Jeeps or, you know, snowmobiling. They all have tools and they all know how to fix their shit if something happens.
Right.
Bow hunting is no different. You're way out there. Something goes wrong. What are you going to do? And that happened to me. That's why when I was young, that's why I started doing this.
Yeah, it was. I want to get into that for sure. I got one more thing I want to talk about before we jump into like some of those cool stories. So here's something I've been thinking about lately is I love my gear. I love nerding out about a broadhead or the bow or you know, what pants or boots. I love my gear. But the reality, my opinion, my reality of it is I see so many hunters spend so much money on gear thinking that's going to make them a better hunter. And yes, that's going to help you, like the right camo brand or like quality of clothing that you're wearing will help you stay in the field longer, be warmer and drier. The better broadheads may give you a few more percentage of it may kill this animal when your shot goes bad. Yes, it's going to help increase percentages a little bit. But my opinion is if you're not doing the things of like scouting, learning how to stalk an animal, learning the species, learning their behaviors, those big things of boots on the ground and just actual hunting, it doesn't matter what product you buy. You're still not going to be successful. You're not even going to get to the chance of seeing the animal, let alone get to a chance to be close enough to pull a bow back to let an arrow fly, you know? So I don't know. That's just where my head's been kind of going lately is I know all these brands, obviously, and me as like a brand myself, a personality or whatever you want to call it is, you know, brands definitely don't want me to say, hey, screw brands and screw equipment. Just go hunt. You could kill something in Walmart gear and a Walmart bow. Just go do it. But I don't know, man, like what's your thoughts? You've been feeling that or what's your thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not on any pro staffs anymore or anything. Cause I just got tired of promoting equipment. As hypocritical as that is, I run a broadhead company, but, I have a lot of friends who are trad bow hunters and I'm not a trad bow hunter. I mean, Nathan Anderson, you could Google him if anyone wants to, he's the first guy to kill a super slam. So all 29 North American big game animals with a longbow. I mean, he's shooting probably 180 feet per second. He's probably never shooting at an animal past 30 yards. So just think about how spoiled we are as compound hunters. You know, he could do what we're doing incredibly easier. Another friend of mine, Adam Brennan, up in the Yukon, he just killed a doll sheep and a grizzly bear with his longbow. Like I have so much respect for the trad guys. It puts things into perspective just how easy we have it. And what I love about them is they're so rooted in the fundamentals of hunting. You know, wind, don't stop moving in the open, be quiet, choose quiet clothing, you know, don't get seen. That's where I have so much respect in bow hunting is, I mean, I respect every bow hunter, but the trad guys are, that's not me. I can't do it.
Yeah. Well, shoot, man, I do have a lot of respect for those guys too. And I'm not a trad guy. And the only reason is, again, I have a lot of respect for those guys, but I want to have the most advantages when I'm hunting. You know, I want to be able to know, okay, if I have an animal within X yardage, my chance of killing that animal is like 90%, right? Unless something crazy goes happen. I want to know that. I don't want to wound an animal. And I probably just don't have the time to get really good at a traditional bow. So I just don't do it. But I think the same way with a rifle, right? Like, you know, long distance shooting is really popular, obviously. And I think it's starting to come back around where, you know, why take the 600 yard shot if you could take a 150 yard shot? You know, if you can become a little bit stealthier, get a little bit closer, increase those odds. I like knowing that I have a good chance at 400 or 500 yards, and I've practiced out to that range. But if I can get a 150 yard shot, I'm going to do it. Right. So that's just my opinion.
No, I agree with you. Like, you know, but to go from compound to trad is like going from rifle to archery hunting in a sense, because you're lowering your chances of success. You're increasing your chances of a wound, but you get so much more fulfillment out of it. I think, I mean, I guess that's a bow hunter saying that, but compound is just where I draw that line for myself. I don't have the confidence to know that I can hit something with no sight at 30 yards. You know, I like my sight. I like that confidence. That's just where I draw the line for myself, but all the respect in the world to the trad guys.
Yeah. I like that challenge too. And that's what makes a hunt special is that extra, like if a hunt's too easy, it's not special for me. I mean, it depends on the hunt, but like you show me an animal that's, you know, 50 yards from camp, and the same animal that's 5 miles from camp, and I'm going to go after the one that's 5 miles from camp. That's just how I am. I don't know. I'm a little tweaked like that, but, so at some point you said string building. I have no clue what it takes to build a string. Tell us more about that.
Well, I didn't either. I needed some new strings. Like I was 16 or whatever. I'm 24 now. So, 8 years ago or whatever. And, I try to buy things in Canada just because customs are a pain. So I won't say the name of the company, but I bought some strings from, you know, one of the highest rated string builders, and I just couldn't believe what I had received. It was, they weren't going on my bow. That's all I'll say. So I just thought, just how do you build a string? It can't be that hard. You can figure it out. So, you know, it takes equipment and, you know, dump $400 or $500 into equipment and, you know, It took me probably 2.5 years of consistently doing it to figure out how to build a perfect string that never creeps, zero peep rotation, that isn't going to stretch. But that's a big thing I do now. I hand build strings, and I've got a group of clients here in Southern Alberta who come to me every year for strings. And that's something I take a lot of pride in.
Interesting, man. Now, all right. Now my interest is absolutely peaked. Zero peep rotation, zero stretch. All right, you may have another client here. Tell me more about this business. So, like, what can you give away without giving away the secret sauce on how you do this?
It's a by hand process. Each string takes like 2 full days. And I'm talking strings, and I build your string and then 2 cables. Each takes like 2 full days to do because I stretch them at 300 pounds overnight. There's just so many little tricks. You do this here, you do this here. You like, there's just so many little things to do that go into the whole process to make it perfect. And it all just went through trial and error because, string builders on the internet don't want to give their secrets away. And I'd give the secrets away, but unless you're building, like, unless I can show you, it doesn't help. But the big thing with me is I don't work on someone's bow unless I have it in my hands. So I'm sorry, I can't help you, Kurt, unless you want to send your bow to Calgary. But I do that because I want to make sure that if the bow comes out of my shop and has my name attached to it, it is absolutely flawless. So I don't want part of my work on a bow that's been half-assed by someone else, you know? So, but yeah, that's, if you're in Calgary and you want work, reach out to me.
Oh, you know, it might be worth the trip. I'm super curious about the string. So maybe we'll definitely do something on the string. But so what kind of, like, you can just buy the material for the strings offline and then have the right equipment. And you just now have the know-how after trial and error to make like a way better string than what most companies are making right now, or what?
Yeah. I mean, you just buy the material and big spools. It just looks like big spools of thread, but it's just bowstring material. And I have it's sitting right here beside me. It's my string jig, which is, how many inches long is it? It's 110 inches long of just a track that you set up. They're called endless loop bowstrings. So you set up 4 posts and you're wrapping your string around it like 11 times so that when the string comes together, you have 22 strands or 24 strands or whatever your string recipe calls for, or whatever. Yeah, it's quite the process. And I believe there's a benefit to hand-built strings over factory. And there's nothing wrong with factory-built strings at all, but they're made in about 3 minutes on a machine. So you're not getting effective stretching. You're getting a beautiful, crisp, clean machine built string, but the long-term performance will be better with a hand built string that took you a week to make.
Yeah, because almost every, I'll venture to say every string that I've ever had in my bow, I don't even like really worry about sighting it in perfectly until that string is stretched.
Yeah.
Until that break-in period. I call it, I thought it was just normal. A break-in period of like, okay, I got to shoot X amount of arrows out of here, let the string stretch, and then I'll start sighting my bow in. So that's not a normal thing then. That shouldn't be happening?
No, it shouldn't be happening. I mean, I'll put a string on my bow and I take about three shots through it before I put my peep in, and all that's doing is settling it out in the cam tracks. But the string itself is stable as can be. You know, it's been stretched at incredible tension for 24 hours. So no, that shouldn't happen. But I mean, think about, you know, bow tech, boy, they don't have time to stretch strings for 24 hours. So I completely get it. But that's where it leaves a place in the market for guys like me.
Yeah. And obviously you're not going to like, can't quite scale up the business. Otherwise you'd be doing the same thing, like making a ton of strings for everybody. Yeah. So it's a very niche, custom made strings, handmade. Very cool, man. That's awesome, yeah, man. Props to you.
Yeah, no, I love doing it. And I love the DIY work. You know, like I started doing it because when I was on a hunt in Wyoming when I was like 14 or 15, and we got to the camp in the late afternoon, just, you know, getting the bows dialed, making sure they're okay after the flights. And my D loop just broke. And I'm sure it was worn out and should have been replaced long ago, but I didn't know what I was doing. Right. So, well, what the hell do we do? no one knew how to do it at camp. I didn't know how to do it. So we had to the next morning drive like an hour and a half to Laramie to some shop there and just to get a D loop replaced. And so I missed half a day hunting. And, you know, as soon as we got back to Calgary in Canada here, my dad brought me to the local bow shop and said, teach this kid how to tie a D loop. And that's just where it all started. Cause I thought I never want to not know what to do again.
Yeah, man, that's a good point. Which again brings me in introspectively to like to myself. It's like, man, I need to learn how to do more shit because I bring a backup bow for if something happens, but I would still have to hike wherever I'm hunting back to my truck or whatever to grab the backup bow. But if you could fix it right there in the field, that would be a lot better.
Yeah, I bring like a little, I call it my archery first aid kit, and it's just a small little, it's actually like one of my girlfriend's makeup bags that I stole from her because it's perfect for my gear. And it's, you know, I got little needle nose pliers and super glue and a lighter. Just, I can fix almost anything, almost. If it requires a bow press, we're SOL. But I've had to do that a few times. I've had to do some big repairs and on other people's equipment too. I've been at camps where guys have been, you know, thankful that I have my little kit there to fix something.
Yeah, man. And even like you were talking about the peep, little slippage, like the twist of the peep.
Yeah.
That happened to me a lot too, where like it was almost started becoming habit until I took it in a bow shop. It's like, okay, twist the little peep first, then draw back. And like, so the peep's straight, you know, like, yeah.
And
my eyes a little bit here, Lee.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what the YouTube channel is all about. So if anyone's out there wants to learn more about this, I put out a video a week all about this type of stuff. Things you can do at home without much special equipment or any. But I mean, yeah, the peep one, that's one of my highest viewed videos it's called Is Your Peep Squared? And you're right. There's a ton of people with bows out there that they twist and then they draw. The question you got to look at is the peep rotating while you draw or is it holding still? It's just off to an angle. If it's holding still, but it's just off to an angle, you're easy. You need a bow press or someone with a bow press to make a quick adjustment, realign your string and you're set. But if it's actually twisting as you go, you have a problem in your string and you probably need a new string to fix that. I mean, it doesn't affect accuracy, but it's annoying as hell.
Yeah. Super annoying, man. And it's annoying for me to know that like something's not quite right and it shouldn't be that way. Then it'll bug me. I don't like taking my equipment out into the field to go kill an animal when things aren't 100% solid. Right. So
I love that attitude. I wish more people had that attitude. It's the same thing with fixed blades versus mechanicals, right? Fixed blades don't fly out of my boat. Well, that you have a problem then. Don't hide it with a mechanical broadhead.
Mm-hmm. 100%. What's your what's that YouTube channel you just mentioned?
It's just the Tooth of the Arrow Broadheads YouTube channel.
Yeah.
It's more of an archery education channel than anything. I don't, you know, it's not a sales pitch channel by any means. I just use our name because we have a following to promote archery education and exactly what we're talking about. Have people understand their equipment better.
Yeah, man. I definitely have to watch a few of those. I've seen a few of your videos. I watched a little bit of it, but I have to watch some more of it. Very cool.
You've got a cool channel. Oh, sorry. I was going to say you have a cool channel too. Like what I love about your channel is your production quality is top notch.
Oh, thanks, bro. I go back and forth of kind of like a style that I want, because that production quality takes a lot of time and energy and effort, where more vlog style would be quicker and easier. I could pop more stuff out. So I'm going to start popping out some more educational stuff, you know, around my own kind of thing. Cause like you talked about is I really have a passion and kind of a heart for that new hunter, or the hunter that's just been hunting and hasn't been successful, you know, cause I came from Nebraska and I tried to elk hunt on my own, archery elk hunt. And I went from like hunting creek lines on whitetail, you know, exactly where the whitetail are going to be, to thousands and thousands of mountainous acres of Forest National Forest BLM land. Like, okay, let's go find the elk with this bow. It like felt like impossible. Anyway, I just have a passion for that, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, and one thing I wanted to touch on was your passion for the fitness side of things. I know that's big for you, and you know, I've done a lot of sheep hunting and goat hunting, which requires a year of training before you do these hunts. But what I do is different. You know, I'm a cardio freak. I don't lift weights. I walk with weight and I run a ton. But I'm curious, what kind of things do you do when you're training for these, you know, a 5 or 10 mile elk hunt where it's like up and down and up and down all day?
No, for sure, man. That's a really good point. And I think the way that you're trained is really smart for hunting. Running is really good for training for hiking, because you're building all those little muscles in your legs. And especially if you do any rucking, putting some weight on your back, I think that's really good. Where I may differ a little bit is one of my big goals is to continue to hunt that backpacking hard hunt until I'm really old. Right? I'm old now, but I want to be really old doing it, like 80, right? I still want to go on that backpacking hunt when I'm like 70, 80 years old. So I do a very collective type of fitness where I'm trying to keep my body healthy and in shape. Which might be a little more weight training or keeping, I do a lot of CrossFit, but keeping a little bit more muscle as I get ramp up closer to season, I do more running and more rucking to get ready for hiking. But here's the little caveat. Here's a little secret I'm going to tell people is I think fitness is real important to stay healthy, stay in shape. And it helps on those harder hunts, but you cannot train for a backpacking hunt. You just really can't, because you go in the gym, you're not going to be there more than gym or a run or whatever. You're not going to spend more than an hour or two at the tops training. And a lot of these backpacking hunts, you may be hiking all day. This might be a 10, 12 hour hike with weight on your back, mountainous terrain. Rarely are you on a trail over boulders and deadfall. And like, there's really no way to really train for that. So my training for that is mental toughness training. That's why I like CrossFit a lot. Because a lot of those workouts really freaking suck. Like, it's just super painful and super high intense, heart rate's high. You want to quit, but it really helps with my mental toughness to like build mental toughness. So when I'm like, you know, 5 miles deep and it's been raining or snowing on me, like I had a hunt last year, an elk hunt where I was back there pretty far. I kind of screwed up. I didn't bring an extra pair of socks because I was running really light. And it had sleeted and snowed and my boots got wet and rain, sleet, snow kind of thing for like 2 days straight. And my boots soaked out and I got really wet. Then it got really cold. And overnight my boots froze, my socks froze. And I'm waking up the next morning with frozen boots and frozen socks. And if you've ever been like super cold, wet, most of your stuff's frozen, you've been starving for 4 or 5 days, completely beat up, and now you have frozen socks and shoes to put on your bare feet, that makes you want to quit really quick. So like that mental toughness training for me really came into play in that moment right there to stick it out, figure it out. I ended up taking my jet boil and unthawing my socks enough to like put them on and just shoving my feet in the frozen boot and hiking in them till they unthawed. But yeah, man, that's kind of my strategies there.
No, man, it's those are the moments. I've had a few of those that you want nothing more than for a helicopter to come pick you up and take you home. But after the fact, they're pretty darn good memories. And you know, you bring up a few really good points too. You cannot train for that stuff. You can get yourself in as good a physical shape as you possibly can. You can get your hips strong and your legs really strong for carrying weight all day. But like on this goat hunt that's on YouTube, it was 9 days and it was 12 to 14 hours a day climbing some of the toughest terrain in North America every single day. You cannot train for that. And you can train your mind for it, though. You can mentally prepare for it. But, you know, you're going to get out there. And we had 3 days where we were completely rained in. There was fog, pouring rain. The inside of your tent is soaked by the end of it. You can't see. There's no point leaving your tent. So you're in your tent eating, you know, candy bars and jet boil food and doing nothing but laying there. That's not conducive to a good workout the next day, which you have to do. So it's you can do your best, but you can't do everything. And one thing I think people don't do enough is train going down. I see a lot of guys on step climbers at the gym, and they just go, you know, they do the stairs all day. That's great for going up, but going down it's the opposite. You know, it puts stress in the opposite muscles in your leg, and I find going down with weight actually harder than going up. So you've got to train that too.
Man, I agree 100%. Going down sucks. I'd rather go up all day long than going down. Just
oh yeah, me too.
Beats up my body, my knees hurt, and your balance is off, and I fall a lot. Yeah, going down sucks. And you made a point of like being so socked into your tent, man. When you can't see outside, you can't see 10 feet outside your tent. Like, can't go hunt, so you're sitting in your tent all day, like. That's mentally tough too.
It sucks. And you know, you have your guys with you there. Like on that hunt, I was with two other guys, but you're not getting out and sitting by a fire. You're all in your tent. You can't really talk. You can't like it. Those days really, really suck. And like what happened to you, I remember there was one of those days where somehow I left one of my boots, just like the opening of my boot outside of the vestibule. And I woke up in the morning, I had dumped my boot out before putting it on. And that just, it's not a start to the day that you want, but you have no choice. What are you going to do? Right.
Yeah. Which I think we're all a little bit tweaked, man. Like what person in their right mind thinks this sounds like a good idea. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Do you ever have it when you come back from, you know, I find kind of that 5 days, once you hit 5 days and longer, I come back into the public and you know, you're at a restaurant, you're in a hotel, and it's just a bit of a mini culture shock for a day. You ever have that?
Yeah, I feel like, well, I feel a little feral coming back. And I just feel like being in nature is just cleansing to the soul, man. I just feel so much at peace, and I really enjoy the physical part of it. And just the challenge, like my thing is like, what's over that next ridge? I'm always like, oh, what's over that next ridge? And then I get myself in trouble because I'm fucking so far out there. Yeah. But yeah, you get back into culture and then things are just different, man. It's really busy and the stress hits and people are retarded and, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You look at things differently. I mean, I love being out there for a week and your phone is completely useless to you. I use my phone I look at my old pictures. I like to do that. And sometimes I'll put music to my ear in the tent when I'm going to sleep or whatever, but you can't text, you can't go on the internet. I love that. And I also love that you don't generally have a mirror. So I think it's so cool to think like, wow, I haven't seen myself in a week. I don't know what I look like.
Yeah.
It's cleansing.
But, and you learn a lot too, is like most people shower every day, right?
Yeah.
But after you've gone 10 days without showering, you realize it's really not that big of a deal. Like your body stops producing oil after so long. And yeah, I mean, your clothes stink and and I don't know. And it was leading me into a completely different topic of like, it's actually healthy for your skin and your microbiome not to shower every day. So now I only shower a couple times a week. So my wife probably hates it, but but it's something that's changed, man. Most people have never gone to that experience of like being out in the wilderness and not showering for multiple days like that, you know? So
no, most people never ever experience that. And it's not easy. Like I said earlier, while you're out there, there's almost every day, there's a point part of you that says, I want to go home. I crave food so bad when I'm out there, man. Like I was on one trip where we straight up ran out of food and they were like planning a plane drop of food for us. And we managed to get out before we needed that. But man, I crave, like, I think about ribs and steak and burgers. Like that's what consumes my mind out there.
Yeah, for sure. And it's easier if you're moving. I found it easier if I'm hiking, I can control that hunger. Because my mind is, or if you're in the animals, whatever you're hunting, if you're in game, it's easier to control that.
Yeah.
Last year, I lost 30 pounds from elk season to caribou season off my body. And I lost a ton of muscle. And I'm going to tell you about this hunt real quick. An episode will be coming out, but this is basically everything we're talking about. Is I went to Adak Island in Alaska and did a caribou hunt there. And I underestimated the island greatly. I wore rubber boots because I thought it rains like almost every day and it's super wet there, right? So I wore rubber boots and I underestimated the terrain. The terrain was way harder than I thought. And we ended up doing like 50 miles in 4 or 5 days. And we killed, me and my camera guy killed 2 caribou and at the same time. And we ended up hiking two. So I put a full caribou on my back. He put a full caribou on his back. We hiked it to the shore 5 miles. 5 miles don't seem like that big a deal, but in that type of terrain, it was really, really hard. And it took us 14 hours to go 5 miles to the shore and then 5 miles back to camp. And that was probably the hardest pack out, the hardest day I've ever had hunting. And what I like about that is anytime I'll have a hard day coming up, I'll remember that day and say, you know what, I did 14 hours, man, of like straight, strenuous, terrible freaking hiking. And I can handle whatever I got going on right now. And we ran out of food. So we're eating our caribou meat. like, thank God we killed something, right? So, but yeah, man, kind of everything we're talking about, crappy weather, hard hiking, running out of food, mental toughness. But I look back and it's like one of my most pleasurable hunts because of those things.
Oh, totally. And it makes you tougher in everything you do every day in your life. It makes me go harder on my runs, makes me go harder in the gym because you think about, you know, this, it's too hot out today. I don't want to run that last mile. I'll walk home. Well, I've done, you know, massive days with the sheep on my back, so I can do this.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of sheep on the back, you had mentioned something about a super slam that you're started or got a good chunk in there. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So it's kind of my life goal is I want to get the super slam of the bow. So for those that don't know, the super slam is the successful taking of all 29 North American big game animals. You can get a super slam with a rifle, muzzle loader, whatever, but I want to do it with a bow. So I've got 9 of 29. And you know, I mean, even if you chop off one a year, that's a 30-year goal. It's a big thing, but yeah, it's taking me to some cool places. I've still got a long ways to go with it, and most of the hard ones are still coming up. But it's cool. You finish it, and you can really feel like you've hunted North America in its entirety.
Oh, for sure. And there's some hard hunts. Some of those too. Like, what would you? What's your top? Your favorite ones out of the 9 that you've gone on so far?
Well, I've been unsuccessful. I shot a doll sheep and a mountain goat, started with my bow, both finished with a rifle, unfortunately, tough hunts. So I don't count those towards my 9, but I love those mountain hunts, just like what we were just talking about. But I love caribou hunting. I've killed 2 caribou, one in Quebec and one in NWT. I think they're the coolest things ever. And you know, the caribou is a really sad story, that just caribou as a whole nowadays, because we are kind of facing that point where their natural time on this earth is coming to an end, which is really a shame. But man, they're a cool animal to hunt, unlike anything else.
Super cool, man. That's one on my, like, I have an itch that I have not been able to scratch with caribou. I went last year to ADAC, but it was a young bull and a cow that we shot, and nothing against that, but it just made that itch even itchier to harvest a mature bull, you know? So, and I feel you, man, like there's that hunt is coming to an end here in North America. The herds are dwindling. I don't know if they have really pinpointed exactly why. I mean, obviously hunting has probably to put a good dent in it, but yeah, I'm with you on the caribou thing. But what do you have coming up, man? Do you have anything this year that's going to hit the Super Slam?
Well, I've been trying to kill mule deer in Alberta for like a couple of years now. It's ridiculous that I've lived here and I haven't killed one. Well, I've killed I killed a mule deer in Mexico. I've killed a pile of does with my bow, but I've never shot a good mule deer buck in Alberta. So that's one that I'm really trying to hammer in on this year. I had a tough hunt for them this year. And I'm working on booking a bison hunt as well, which counts for the 29. I've done the muskox, which is incredible, and I love the meat. So I want to do the bison now, which is like your kind of plains version of that. So those are the two that are on my list right now.
So you knocked off a muskox with a bow?
Yeah, I shot a muskox. I was back in 2016 in Nunavut. That was it was unbelievably cold. The day I shot that muskox, it was minus 55 Celsius. So I don't know what that is Fahrenheit, but it's a type of cold that you can't imagine until you step into it. People told me that before I went up. These guys who had done it said, you know, you don't know what that cold is like till you step off the plane. And I thought, oh, whatever. It's, you know, I've lived in Canada my whole life. It's cold. No, they're right. It's different. It's a next level. Yeah. And I shot that bull at only 49 pounds because I was nursing a shoulder injury at the time. So you can shoot big animals with low draw weight.
Yeah. No, you absolutely can. How, like, I know, like, muskox, it's one of their natural defenses to all herd up and like protect themselves like that. Was it hard to like get a good bull picked out so you knew you weren't going to kill or hurt or wound another one?
Yeah, it is hard. Like it's hard to get close to them because at first their instinct is to run, of course. And I mean, it's flat and they can run faster than you by every metric. So eventually when you get close to them and enough of you, you need a group of people to make them feel threatened enough to herd up. They all stand in a big circle with all the calves in the middle, which are the cutest little things. If you've ever seen a muskox calf, they're the most adorable animal you've ever seen. But it is tricky because the cows have horns too. And I don't look at them every day like whitetail or mule deer. So I have a tough time judging. So you're relying on the Inuit who are there with you to tell you what's what. And you kind of start to figure it out. But then when you pick your bull, they're in a big clump. They're in a herd. So you just walk and circle and kind of play chess with them. And this is all happening at, you know, 40, 50 yards, hoping that they don't charge you, which happens. I know a guy who was charged twice by a muskox. And it can, for me, it took like 45 minutes to an hour, somewhere in there, until that bull just gave me the split second where no one was behind him. And thankful, because I did get a pass through. But man, that's an unbelievable hunt. And the best meat I've ever eaten in my life, period. It's the only wild game I've had that's truly marbled, like through and through. Really? Yeah.
Every wild game I've had, you don't get that marbling. It's super lean, but a muskox, you get that marbling. Huh?
Yeah. Like I see it the odd time on, you know, a whitetail up here that's been living on someone's farm and eating a ton of grain. You'll see a little bit, but muskox is like, it looks like a high grade beef.
Huh?
It's beautiful meat. Amazing.
Well, I'll just add that to the list of things I want to go do now.
you should do a muskox hunt. That one's, it's incredible. Yeah.
Oh, shoot. Riley, I don't want to take any more of your time, man. I know we both got to get back to it. So thanks for being on the podcast. You guys, this is the Western Obsessions TV podcast. My guest today was Lee with Tooth the Arrow Broadheads. Hope you enjoy it. And thanks a lot, Lee. Appreciate you.
Thanks, Kurt. Appreciate it.
All right.
This is the Western Obsessions TV podcast, where hunting's not a hobby, it's an obsession.